Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. A portion of what I will read on today's program is what I wrote, therefore necessitates a disclaimer that the thoughts are mine, and perhaps mine only, in all the cosmos. Monday is Columbus Day, and so I am going to read a little bit about it. I call it Hello Columbus. 523 years ago, and this is something I wrote, by the way, this is the one the disclaimer is about. 523 years ago, on Friday, October 12th, 1492, a Genoa seaman stumbled onto the Western Hemisphere while seeking passage to the Far East. One world was born that day, but the world that was here began that instant to die. Christopher Columbus missed his mark by half a world, and by that doubled the world's size. The old civilizations of Europe sent their most favored and dumped their disreputable on the shores of the New World. And although they were equals in their fervent obliteration of the worlds they found, and they turned on each other as well. Two centuries later, the great thinkers of the 18th century Enlightenment debated the consequences of the European discovery of the American continents and concluded the costs had been too high for the gains. The great thinkers wished the great navigator had never set sail or had perished in his three small ships on the ocean, although someone would have claimed discovery of the New World eventually, and many had made landfalls in the same hemisphere from both Atlantic and Pacific Oceans hundreds, even thousands of years earlier. The presumed native peoples were already here. And Columbus might himself have wished he never sailed either. He died poor and in disgrace. Unknown at first to the invading Europeans, who sought wealth with murder and enslavement of the primitive tribes they initially encountered, were great civilizations as autocratic, expansive, and cruel as their own. A renaissance of Western civilization, a rebirth of classical knowledge, culminated in the calamitous error of Columbus, who refused to believe that he had blundered upon an entirely unknown landmass that blocked his passage to the ancient East. And immediately, Columbus began the cruel harvest of native inhabitants that was to last the better part of four centuries. The dispute between 18th century intellectuals such as Rousseau, Voltaire, et al., argued that the European discovery of the Americas had cost millions of lives and the wholesale destruction of native culture, and was thus a blight upon the history of civilization. As Native Americans on both continents, North and South, perished by the millions from slaughter, forced labor, disease, and despair, it seemed that half of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for New World plantations and for gold and silver mines, and millions died before reaching the Americas. New civilizations spawned upon the ruins of obliterated ones, often deeply influenced by them, yet scarcely regarded by their vanquishers as civilizations. The annual observance of Columbus's first voyage to the Americas, named after a later Italian explorer who was not deluded into believing he had reached Asia, is heated and controversial. Some celebrate, others bitterly denounce the intrusions of Europe upon the Western Hemisphere, and half a millennium of conquest, epidemic, and cultural genocide. Words of placation or condemnation are exchanged. The old world encountered, conquered, converged with the new, depending on the perspective of the speakers. However one might feel, Columbus and his successors are as inescapable a fact of history as a great meteor that apparently set fire to North America in a matter of minutes and ended the long reign of dinosaurs. Columbus's voyage began the end of the long seclusion of descendants of Stone Age Asian hunters who had crossed over on foot and by boat in periods when the Bering Sea was shallow and the continents narrowly linked at their northern extremities, and were subsequently cut off from the rest of the human world when the waters rose again. The ancient cycles of pre-Columbian civilizations disappeared under the onslaught of invaders who were oblivious of them. In the same manner, sometime in the future, the civilizations that have grown from the ruins will in turn be devoured, deteriorate, or self-destruct. And in the words of Lafcadio Hearn, who favored the resurgence of Asia over the West, post-Columbian cultures will be as mist as the ichthyosaur. A slighter, less controversial acclaim is paid Robert Gray and his claim of discovery of the fabled River of the West, exactly 3 centuries after Columbus bumped into the Northern Hemisphere on his way to India. Gray, a Yankee captain from New England, navigated his square-rigged sailing ship, the Columbia Rediviva, Columbus Reborn, through wild surf at the river's entrance on May 11, 1792, and named the river Columbia after his ship and after the Admiral of the Ocean Sea himself. Yet the consequences have been a microcosm of all that Europe accomplished or ruined in this half of the world. Almost immediately, white Americans and Europeans came in Gray's wake to trade, to settle, to supplant, and eventually eradicate native culture. The Great River itself has been tamed with dams, the once massive forests on both sides of its banks logged and replaced with cities and farms, and the millions of salmon that until only recently were so numerous it was claimed a person could cross the wide river on their backs have dwindled to only an endangered few. The exchange of a natural wilderness for a human wasteland is relatively recent. The Pacific Northwest has been a last small pocket for Western exploration, with the exception of the poles and Antarctica. Boston Captain Gray opened up a major portion of the last frontier, yet the annual celebration of his day of discovery every May 11th has less to do with exploration than it does the current and future exploitations by Nauvoo natives who dwell among the vanished ruins of a fatally vulnerable culture our predecessors callously overran. The present tenants of the Columbia River Basin inherit a legacy of raw exploitation and waste. The riches once so abundant have been despoiled, virtually all used up in only a few generations. Even the Big River, second largest in North America, has not escaped the pollution of modern society. Known as one of the most radioactive rivers in the world as a result of Hanford plutonium and Trojan nuclear waste, and it is a garbage dump for towns and cities along its banks. Industrial and pesticide pollution are major offenders. The current generation is bitterly divided about Gray's legacy, and each side of the controversy utilizes extremes in its arguments to exploit or preserve. On the one hand, it might be considered that a great civilization has reached its maximum westward expansion on the North American continent in the Pacific Northwest. On the other is the extreme environmental degradation which a gigaproliferating population and its bombastic technology have wrought upon the landscape. It is unfortunate that what remains of Gray's legacy is coveted by the nation at large, including the water of the river itself. It is likely that crucial decisions have been removed from local management, such as building huge liquefied natural gas, LNG, and crude oil export terminals at the mouth of the Columbia River. And what about the 2 deteriorating nuclear facilities that befoul the river? And just as ominous, a massive earthquake that is predicted for some time soon will rearrange the region into something very different. That future earthquake looms like a monstrous evil spirit over everything else. We who live on this rocky storm-swept coast are stunned by the recent revelation of a chapter of local history we hadn't known before. Our magnificent Pacific Northwest is doomed, at least for the short term, part of a cycle of earthquakes and tsunamis that seem to occur every 3 centuries on average. And not only do we learn that we are most likely to be the latest victims of a contiguous series of earthquakes and tsunamis, we suddenly discover we are at least half a century past that average for the next one. The shock has not quite subsided, and with the exception of a foresightful few, we are, as a whole, dreadfully unprepared for this overdue catastrophe. The ratios vary from 1 in 3 to 1 in 10, the chances of the dynamic duo demolishing our small society of beach towns during the next half century. What we have is a failure of civilizations to communicate. We know about other perennial sites of natural disaster from the earliest periods of writing, and perhaps there are earlier records from as yet undiscovered cave paintings or rock inscriptions. There are records across civilizations, even. These perpetual places of calamity are doggedly recorded because most of the survivors return to rebuild after each recurrent devastation, such as the urban sprawl around Italy's notoriously active volcano, Mount Vesuvius, and those who remain to rebuild after recent massively destructive and lethal Ring of Fire earthquakes in Japan, Chile, and Nepal. We can't leave out San Francisco's resurrection from earthquake rubble and fire, nor indigenous survivors of the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami who remain and wait for the next big one. But a portentous historical disconnect has lately been revealed between two civilizations, one which invaded and essentially ravaged the other to near extinction in three centuries. The dominating interlopers felt too superior to the cultures they displaced to pay much but token attention to their methods of recording history, among a plethora of other arrogancies. We know little of our predecessors' many thousands of years' history in these parts, assorted myths and a few bones and arrowheads to fill in the vast gaps of time in broadly general rather than specific narrative, until recently. Now, a few generations distant from their expulsion as hemispheric monarchs, we are almost pathetically interested in their experiences, especially with recurrent earthquakes and tsunamis. And so, just the day before yesterday, we have at last connected native myths with real history. A few of those old tales that were scholarly derided or simply ignored have to do with a tremendous earthquake and subsequent inundation by a massive tsunami in about the year 1700 AD. The native stories are related in terms of generations rather than by calendar dates. Other signs have tallied with the old tales, such as tsunami-drowned forests calculated to have been killed by saltwater 300 years ago. Plate tectonics has enlightened us further about local earthquakes and tsunami cycles. Any illusory sense of earthly permanence has been ripped right out of us, like a heart might be wrenched from a person, an abject collective despair at the forthcoming disintegration of a communal heart. We live now with a death notice few, if any of us, suspected. Although several hundred thousand deaths and thousands more injuries are predicted, it might be possible that most of us who live on the Oregon and Washington coasts, as well as Vancouver Island and the BC coast, might survive such a stupendous earthquake and tsunami combination, similar to those of the history we have just been slapped awake about. After all, somebody obviously lived to tell the tales that have passed up through the successive lifetimes. But our homes and communities will be wrecked. Family members and friends will die. Probably, like survivors of other cataclysms, most survivors of our future earthquake and tsunami will rebuild along the new shorelines and riverbanks after clearing away the dead and debris of what had been their former lives. Our predecessors here likely did the same many times. And now that I've finished on that happy note, my story, I'd like to read something by Dr. Robert Blake, which I just got in the mail. It's called, he calls it, Guns Are Us. Now, Robert Blake is an essayist and retired educator who lives on the Long Beach Peninsula. And I published him in my newspaper, along with his wife, many times, and I have read both of their articles that they sent me for this radio program. He wrote this article for the Chinook Observer, which printed it September 30th, the day before the shootings at Umpqua College in Roseburg. Guns Are Us by Dr. Robert Brake. It's difficult to remain up to date about the latest horrific mass shooting, since there's probably another gun-related tragedy unfolding somewhere in America. Most recently, two Virginia journalists were gunned down on live TV by mentally disturbed Victor Lee Flanagan, motivated by the June 17th Charleston, South Carolina mass shooting at a church. Then came the predictable burst of public outrage and sorrow, followed by a series of "Do Something Now" legislative proposals meant to prevent similar future tragedies. But, as we all know, nothing was enacted. Indeed, gun sales once again soared, and a majority of Americans, 52%, said they felt that protecting their right to own guns was more important, quote-unquote, than controlling access to them. How sad. Here's a grim little parlor game. Ask someone how many United States gun deaths they think have occurred since the Sandy Hook massacre on December 14, 2012. The answer, as of April 15, 2015, 82,033 and over 100 school shootings. After Sandy Hook, NRA Lightning Rod spokesman Wayne LaPierre urged more guns in schools and seemed outraged that many Americans, including 75% of NRA members polled, wanted reasonable background checks as part of a solution. LaPierre seemed to think of gun control advocates as people painting obscenities on the Statue of Liberty. It seems like nobody wants to blame the shooter. Even President Obama, whose response to Sandy Hook included his remarks that God has called them home. Talk not about blaming the shooter. One deranged shooter killed 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook. So much for the guns don't kill people argument. The old standby of the true gun crazies is that confiscating guns is the first step. The first step to evil government crushing patriotic American gun owners. Just as the first kiss invariably leads to pregnancy, the single joint leads to heroin, and a Band-Aid leads to surgery. My mind falls faint. Apparently, the Second Amendment fanatics' answer is to do nothing about guns. That includes semi-automatic weapons and magazines like the ones that allowed 26 Sandy Hook victims to be ripped apart by Adam Lanza's Bushmaster XM15 in 5 minutes on December 14, 2012. The NRA may have had something in mind when it diabolically proposed an armed guard in every school, as though more guns in schools would neutralize would-be killers. Presumably, more guns would also protect people in churches, taverns, and movie theaters. As is well known, the National Rifle Association is still humorously claiming to be all about gun safety, is still joined at the waist with gun manufacturers, as securely as Chang and Eng, the famous Siamese twins. So if just 100,000 schools subscribe to LaPierre's plan, which would be, let's see now, how many gun sales? Really, you have to hand it to the gun industry. It's an impressive little sales cycle they've created. Every massacre draws attention to their products, yet somehow never to the people ultimately responsible for their production. It is always the hunters, most of whom are responsible gun owners, who bear the brunt of liberal ire, or the rednecks, or the vendor at the gun show selling them secondhand. So next time you're horrified by massacres like Columbine, Virginia Tech, the Sikh Temple shooting, the Aurora Theater shooting, Fort Hood, a military base, or Sandy Hook, realize this, quote, "Most people agree that there's a middle ground between gun control hardliners who see every crime as an excuse to enact tougher gun laws and the NRA, which see every crime as an excuse to sell more guns. The Second Amendment deserves defending, but does anyone really believe that anyone should be able to buy any gun anywhere at any time. If yes, they're siding with less than 10% of America. If not, they need to say so." Unquote. By the way, those last remarks were issued by famed Republican pollster Frank Luntz in the January 2nd, 2013 issue of the Washington Post. According to a 2012 CNN analysis of gun ownership data, a decreasing number of American gun owners own two-thirds of the nation's 300-plus million guns, and as many as one-third of all the guns on planet Earth. Yes, a lot of crazy people have guns, and at least 40% of them can buy guns without background checks, via private sales, gun show sales, or online. What's scary is that a small group of gun enthusiasts are stockpiling munitions, and some of them are paranoid, and in some cases, delusional. They're the ones who tell you, number one, it's in the Constitution, and number two, we need to protect our families. First, the Constitution was written a long time ago, back when the founders were imagining militias armed with muskets. Second, the number of people who use guns to successfully defend themselves has been wildly overestimated. People use guns when other means of de-escalation are available, and quite often they end up dying when they try to use guns as a mode of self-defense. The confiscatory argument is strange. Oddly, the Second Amendment fanatics who fear that big, bad government will take away their rights also advocates for a strong military. Do they really believe that their people's militia could be any match for the military they helped create? It would take extremely skillful Bushmaster wielders to hold out for long against big, bad government's jet bombers, rocket grenades, tear gas, heavy-duty cannons, napalm, offshore gunships, and drones. Here's my progressive caveat. Guns can't be blamed for all the country's ills. In recent years, the U.S. government has enthusiastically worked to defund mental health care programs, perhaps a leading cause of mentally ill people going undiagnosed and unsupervised. Combine that lackluster social safety net with under-regulated gun markets, and you have a perfect storm of senseless death. So what kind of melancholy conclusion can I draw from all this? It might appear that, given the gun lobbyists' unceasing propaganda and the NRA's threats to destroy political careers, if anything, anything is proposed to threaten the Second Amendment, the best thing you and I, as Americans, can do as protection against getting shot at any moment is to, without delay, move to any other country or planet. But I'll continue to hold out hope, hope that someday Americans will come to their senses and do the right thing. In a lighter vein, I recall Dick Cavett's story about a cantankerous Nebraska farmer known for his plinking with his .22 at passing cars in which he perceived enemies. He ingeniously rigged up a shotgun in his house, trained on the inside of his front door, so as to widely distribute any intruder. It seems he was a touch forgetful. Thoughtful listeners can finish the story. And that was Guns Are Us by Dr. Robert Brake, who lives, he's a retired educator and an essayist who lives on the Long Beach Peninsula. And as I said earlier, this story of his appeared in the Chinook Observer one day before the shootings in Roseburg. How much time do I have now, Kate? I'd like to continue this program with an editorial that Stephen Forrester wrote for the Daily Astorian on July 13th, which sort of coincides with my earlier story about Columbus and earthquakes. Rising ocean ends business as usual. The authoritative and relatively cautious National Wildlife Federation released a disturbing report detailing the coming loss of 19 square miles of dry land around the Columbia River and Willapa Bay and Tillamook Bay because of rising sea levels related to global warming. At the same time, a different process is predicted to eat away much of the dune land and beach in front of Seaview and Long Beach, Washington. A startling Oregon State University study describing this erosion threat is certain to cause alarm, and so it should. The losses predicted by the Wildlife Federation, the OSU study, and an earlier exhaustive five-year analysis of local erosion led by the U.S. Geological Survey all strongly argue for careful planning. A burgeoning Pacific Northwest population and a flood tide of urban baby boomer retirees are adding to existing development pressures along our beautiful coasts. These development plans are certain to increasingly push into areas that are known to be risk for inundation and erosion. It was never a good idea to permit building on the sand dunes that have grown westward in the past century on the southern third of the Long Beach Peninsula. They grew in the decades following construction of jetties at the mouth of the Columbia, and people incorrectly attributed it to the beach being shielded from the ocean's ravages. But to oversimplify a complex process, what was actually happening was the gradual relocation and depletion of a huge sandbar named Peacock Spit. It was swept north over a period of decades, its sands deposited in front of Seaview and Long Beach. Now it is gone, or nearly so, and nothing is replacing it. Less dramatically, a similar process has occurred south of the Columbia's mouth. The building that has taken place thus far on newly created land is understandable, given the character of U.S. property rights and the normal inclinations of local elected officials in favor of development. All things considered, our area has done comparatively well at resisting the siren's call to profit from developing shifting sand dunes. What would not be understandable or forgivable is permitting additional development to occur in the threatened zones. Though it is conceivable that changes in how the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers disposes of Columbia sediments might slow expected erosion, the nation's current financial situation does not lend itself to bailing out cute little beach towns. If local planning commissions and their staffs are responsible and competent, they will put the brakes on additional westward development in dunes north and south of the Columbia's mouth and in areas threatened by rising sea levels. 10 or 20 years from now, if these threats don't fully materialize, our communities can reassess the situation. By the same token, owners of threatened land shouldn't be charged premium property tax rates on seashore land that is expected to disappear. Lenders and insurers also must look long and hard at this situation. People have a difficult time imagining that what is dry land today will be breaking surf a few years from now. But in geological time, the dunes have existed for a fraction of a heartbeat. They are ephemeral, not to be trusted or built upon. More sadly, a rising ocean will destroy land that has existed far longer. We are smart enough to see those threats as real and act accordingly. And before I finish, I'd like to make note that the Federal Regulatory Commission, FERC, has refused to extend the October 6th deadline for comment on LNG. But FERC says it will accept late public input. So get your opinion in quickly. I am like nearly everyone I know. None of us wants LNG on the Columbia or in Oregon at all. FERC should get it straight. An overwhelming majority of the people in the Columbia Basin who would be dangerously exposed to LNG don't want to be. We don't want LNG. And this has been Michael McCusker.